that we reduced our numbers down to half. These are the real. You guys really wanted to listen. They were just like, I wasn't sure about it, so whatever. But I have a name tag on, because if you weren't aware, I'm not Phil, who's usually up here talking. So I have a name tag. This is from our night. We just went to a conference with the youth group. So this is from. I just happened to be wearing it because that's what it was. So just in case you forget what my name is, it's Jacob Waldo. So you can all, forget. Okay. But I think for the most part, all of you know me. But just in case you don't, I'll give you a little bit about me. Name's Jacob. I am the son of Phil. He's always up here talking to you, and you guys all know that. And I am 23 years old. And at this conference that we just went to, everyone thought I was in high school. They were always like, what grade are you in? I was like, I'm in like 17th grade, you know. I'm really, really old. But they don't think I am. But anyways, that's who I am. And I'm going to be giving you a lesson today, okay? Will that be all right with you guys? I mean, if it's not, I mean, I don't even know what we do. We just be like, all right, goodbye, I guess. I'll see you later. We're going to do that. But I am going to be reading from Judges chapter 3. So if you have a Bible, you should get that out, because I'm not going to have any notes on the screen or anything for you. It's all going to be straight from the Word. I'm going to process through this, okay? So if you have your Bible, you should have it. If you don't, we can get you one if you really would like one, okay? So we're going to read from Judges chapter 3, starting in verse 12, okay? And we're going to be talking about this guy named Ehud in the Bible, all right? Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of context about the book of Judges. I'm sure a lot of you just know what the book of Judges is about, but it's in the Old Testament. It's one of the first books. It's the one right after Joshua. And if you remember the Joshua book, that's Joshua is the guy who came right after Moses. You know, Moses parted the sea, like that, and then he led Israel out of Egypt, and then Joshua took over after him. And then after Joshua died is Judges. That's right after that, Judges happens, okay? And in Judges, there's this thing that happens over and over and over. There's this cycle for Israel. It's repeated like 6 or 7 times, I think. And what happens is they fall into sin because they don't have a leader or anybody to guide them. So Israel starts falling into sin. They start worshiping other gods. Because without Joshua, they forget. They're like, well, I'm no leader. I'm just going to do whatever I want because they're stupid. They need guidance, like we all need guidance, don't we? And they needed guidance. So when they don't have that guidance, they start to worship other gods and they fall into sin. So God's like, well, I don't like that. So he starts bringing judgment on them. Iron fist, lightning, on down on them. And he allows another nation around them to attack them and conquer them and put them under servitude under them. And that's what happens in this one as well. Someone takes over and then they are serving under this nation, okay? So then they're under servitude, they're under oppression of this nation for a while, and they realize, they're like, oh no, we've sinned. You know, it takes them years, which is, I feel like it should take you a day or something, like, oh no, we're under oppression? Maybe we should cry out to the Lord or something, but it takes them like 18 years, which is like a whole man life right there. That's a long time. Anyways, so they turn, they say, cry out to God, God save us, and God replies. God answers and sends them a judge, or a better word is really just a rescuer, someone to rescue them from their present situation and save them and guide them along the path, because they need a guide. They need someone to help them who is in constant contact with the Lord. So that God answers, and then he sends the judge, and then that judge rescuer has victory over the enemy that is suppressing them, and then they have a time of peace, okay? And then right after that, assumedly, the judge or the rescuer dies, and then they fall back into sin again, and then God's like mad at them, and then he sends someone to help them because they cry to him, and then, you know, it just keeps going and going and going a whole bunch of time in the book of Judges. That's literally the whole thing. If you guys know Samson, he was one of the guys, you know, the guy with long hair, and he liked women, and then he just was really flirty and cut his hair and then broke things with his arms. That's Samson. Okay? But I'm going to read this story. I'm going to read the whole thing. It's chapters 3 in Judges. Verses 12 to 30, okay? So I'm going to read the whole thing. So it's kind of lengthy, so it would be good if you're reading along. Otherwise, you might start daydreaming, because I do that all the time. So I would expect that you would too, because it's just normal, all right? But I'm going to read it from the New Living Translation, so it might be a little bit different than some of you guys are reading. But starting in verse 12 says, once again, the Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight, and the Lord gave King Eglon of Moab control over Israel because of their evil. Eglon enlisted the Ammonites and Amalekites as allies, and then went out and defeated Israel, taking possession of Jericho, the city of palms. And the Israelites served Eglon of Moab for 18 years. But when the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help, the Lord again raised up a rescuer to save them. His name was Ehud, son of Gera, a left-handed man of the tribe of Benjamin. The Israelites sent Ehud to deliver their tribute money to King Eglon of Moab. So Ehud made a double-edged dagger that was about a foot long, and he strapped it to his right thigh, keeping it hidden under his clothing. He brought the tribute money to Eglon, who was very fat. That's just funny. After delivering the payment, Ehud started home with those who had helped carry the tribute. But when Ehud reached the stone idols near Gilgal, he turned back. He came to Eglon and said, "I have a secret message for you." So the king commanded his servants, "Be quiet," and he sent them all out of the room. Ehud walked over to Eglon, who was sitting alone in a cool upstairs room, and Ehud said, "I have a message from God for you." As King Eglon rose from his seat, Ehud reached with his left hand, pulled out the dagger strapped to his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. The dagger went so deep that the handle disappeared beneath the king's fat, so Ehud did not pull out the dagger, and the king's bowels emptied. Awesome. Then Ehud closed and locked the doors of the room and escaped down the latrine. After Ehud was gone, the king's servants returned and found the doors to the upstairs room locked. They thought he might be using the latrine in the room, so they waited. And when the king didn't come out after a long delay, they became concerned and got a key. And when they opened the doors, they found their master dead on the floor. While the servants were waiting, Ehud escaped, passing the stone idols on his way to Sarai. When he arrived in the hill country of Ephraim, Ehud sounded a call to arms. Then he led a band of Israelites down from the hills. "Follow me," he said, "for the Lord has given you victory over Moab, your enemy." So they followed him, and the Israelites took control of the shallow crossings of the Jordan River across from Moab, preventing anyone from crossing. They attacked the Moabites and killed about 10,000 of their strongest and most able-bodied warriors. Not one of them escaped. So Moab was conquered by Israel that day, and there was peace in the land for 80 years. Okay? That's a little story. It's kind of long. Sorry about that, but that's the whole story. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to break it down, because you guys know that story now. You get it. But you don't necessarily know exactly what happened. You like you know the basic story, but you don't know all the certain elements in it that really make it the story that it is. You know, there's certain little things that we just don't always see. We read right over it and like, oh, yeah, that's okay, that happened. But I'm going to break it down so we can actually understand what really happened and why certain things are said and why God put them in the Bible for us to read now. Okay? So verses 12 and 14 is all about Moab taking over. The Israelites decide that they don't want to follow God anymore, worship other idols. And then, you know, so then God says, "Oh, I'm going to let this guy take over Moab." And that's the first step of the continual cycle, right? They forget God, worship other people, and then God sends someone over them to oppress them for a while, okay? So that's what's happening. Moab takes over Eglon. That's the king of Moab at that time. Takes over, and he's over them for 18 years, it says, right at the end of verse 14. Served over for 18 years, okay? So they are in servitude, oppression of Moab for 18 years, all right? Then verse 15, right at the beginning. "But when the people of Israel cried out to the Lord," so they cry out. That's the next stage in the cycle. They cry out to the Lord. They realize they were sinners. They realize that they've done wrong, and they need God to help them because they can't do it by themselves. They realize that, and God, merciful God that he is, right after that says, "Then God raised up a rescuer to save them," which is the very next thing in the cycle. God raises up someone to help them, okay? So he responds with this guy named Ehud, okay? And it has some special characteristics about him, which is important to note, because oftentimes there's guys in the Bible or ladies in the Bible, and it just says their name. You know, it's like this guy, son of whoever, daughter of whoever, and it doesn't give any explanation. But this one does give a specific explanation about who Ehud was. So first of all, it says that he's left-handed. Sweet. I mean, anybody in here left-handed? Any left-handers? Okay, so you're weird. Got it. Now we know. Now we know. Now, my grandpa is actually left-handed, and he eats really weird. He has to have his elbow way up here when he eats, so you can't sit next to him on that side. Like, he always has to be on the end or, like, on the some weird corner so that he can eat that way. I don't know, any of you left-handers like that? Where you're just like, wow, look at my elbow. I'm eating food. I don't know. Anyways, Yeah, he's left-handed. Okay, that's just the key. He's left-handed, and he's also part of the tribe of Benjamin, son of Gary's tribe of Benjamin, because that's where his father's from. Which is ironic, because the tribe of Benjamin literally translates to son of the right hand, and he's left-handed. Which is just... I just feel like God, when he's just like making the story happen, he's like, this is going to be funny one day. This is going to be great. He's right-handed, but he's really left-handed. I'm so clever. Oh, man, I'm God. Look at me. That's what he's thinking right now. He's thinking how awesome he is. Anyways, okay, so, and also at the very end, after it explains who he is, it says that Ehud's going to deliver the tribute money to King Inglid of Moab, which is the normal thing that would happen because they are under oppression to the Moabites, so they're going to give them money. That's just what happens. When someone takes over, you know, like if Rome took over like that, you know, Rome took over most of the whole world back in the day, and then everyone who was under them just gave them money because they're like, you're going to give me money or we're going to kill you. So that's what happens here. This is a normal thing, so the Israelites assign Ehud to give the money, okay? And then verses 16 to 30 is really the real story, okay? The whole 12 to 15 is basically just, in any story where it gives just kind of some slight context in the story so you kind of know what's going on. In any good story, it builds it up so you kind of understand. You're not just like, oh, okay, so this Ehud guy did this thing. It explains who he is, what happened before that, and now here's the real story of what is going on at this time. So 16 to 30, in verse 16, it explains that he made a dagger. And I think some of your versions might say sword, but really it was a dagger because it's only a foot long. I mean, I have a ruler. This is his dagger. It's this long. This is how long his dagger was. Just like this. And it says that he strapped it to his right thigh. So he straps it right here, you know, whatever duct tape on there, because they had that back then. And then he hides it under his clothing, all right? That's just key. That's important to note that it says that at all. Because, I mean, why wouldn't it say it? I mean, everything in the Bible is very important, even if it's one word. So it's very important that God puts that in there in verse 16. And then verse 17 says he brought the tribute to Eglon, who was very fat. So again, he's bringing the regular tribute that would be normal. Ehud's the one doing that. And explains that Eglon is very fat, which is another important thing to note. It's just, he's super fat. He's a fatty, you know. He's a whale. He's a gigantic mammoth, okay? That's Eglon. All right, moving on down to 18. So after he gives them the payment, I mean, they don't like them, so they don't hang out and chat and fellowship and hang out together. So he's leaving. That's just what happens. Ehud starts home with those people who were helping him carry the tribute. So he's leaving. In verse 19, he gets to these stones of Gilgal, which is a ways away. It's not like right outside the city gates. It's like a ways away, long ways away, okay, miles and miles away. And he says, okay, friends, you should keep going. I'm going to turn back. So he turns back, and he gets back to the city that Eglon is in and says, hey, I got a secret message for you. Which, if anybody tells you you got a secret message from me, you're like, sweet, I want to know what it is. So King Eglon agrees with that, and he says, hey, servants, you guys all get out of here. Be quiet. Leave us, okay? So that's what he does. King Eglon kicks all of his servants and all of his officials that were in that room with him out, so it's just Ehud and Eglon, okay? And this is all part of Ehud's plan because he wanted to get Eglon alone, okay? And then verses 20 to 22, this is the exciting part. This is super exciting and super gross all at one time. This is where it happens because he says, hey, I got a message for you from God. So then Eglon stands up, and then Ehud's like, stabs him right in the stomach, and then he dies, and his stomach basically explodes. Okay, that's pretty much it. That's what it says. When it empties, literally, it just, like, his intestines coming out, stomach, you know, it smells nasty because that's just gross area of your body. Super gross, okay? Super nasty. And then right after that, he locks the door. He locks the door that he had him in, and basically this room is basically his bedroom. When it says he's in this cool room, the upper room, it's his bedroom, and there's probably a bathroom in there because he's the king, so he gets all the amenities that you need for there. So that's his bathroom. So he locks the door, and it's important to note that he locks the door because he's buying time. And that is explained in this 24 to 25 because he's buying time because they wait a long time before they even open the door, lock the door. And he escaped the way he came. It says that he eventually he went past the stones he came, and then he goes to Sarai and talks to the Israelites there. So 24 and 25 is after Ehud was gone, the servants returned and found the doors locked. Because they're like, okay, so it's locked. So they assume that he's using the bathroom, which makes sense because it stinks. Okay? And it would stink really bad because he's not a small person. He's a large person. And I would assume it smells a lot worse. because it's just got a lot in there. It's got to come out, and it stinks. Okay, so they assume he's going to the bathroom. Okay, assume he's going to the bathroom, and they're just like, okay, he's going to the bathroom, and whatever. So they wait a long enough time, so that Ehud can get back to the Israelites and back with an army before they even know. Okay, that's how long it is. And I'm saying this is miles, and he's probably walking, so it's a long time. Okay. But he's also the king of Eglon. So, king of Moab, they didn't want to interrupt him and get killed or chop their heads off or something like that. So they just wait. Okay, it's important to note. So then they get a key. Eventually, then they unlock the door and they find him dead. And that's all it says. They find him dead. They don't say like, oh, and they called an army together and they made everybody freak out and everybody cried and screamed. No, it just says they found him dead. That's all it says. And then verse 26. This verse is happening at or before 24 and 25, when it says that the servants of Eglon were waiting for Eglon to get out of the bathroom, and then he didn't. So it's happening right at that or before that because that's what happened. So, yes. And then it also mentions that Ehud is leaving. He's passing the stone idols on his way to Sarai. And then verses 27 to 30 is all about how he gets to the Israelites. He says, hey, listen here. They don't know he's dead yet. So we should go over there and attack him because they have no idea, and he can't assemble an army fast enough before we can get there. So he gets all these people, and they go over there, and they kill 10,000 of them, and they kill them all. They all die. No one escapes, and then they have peace over the land. Okay? And that was a little bit of a lengthy explanation, so if you were sleeping, shame. But there's important things I want you to get from this passage. The first thing is that Ehud had a disadvantage. He had a weakness. He had an imperfection. And that was that he was left-handed. And you may not think it really isn't. It's not an imperfection or weakness any day today. It's not what we would think. But in that time, it was considered peculiar and unnatural. And actually, it was considered that it would hinder your ability to work, to fight, to do anything. If you're left-handed, you are considered unnatural and weak because you are left-handed. And there's many other things of that day. If you were like small or if you were deformed or any other things that were considered weak, and this was his, he was left-handed, okay? The world told him that he was a weak and disadvantaged person. That's the first thing I want you to know, that it's in there. And it's such a small thing. I mean, it's only three words in there. It just says he was a left-handed man. That's all that's in there. And this is the most important thing in this whole entire story. Nothing else would matter if those three words were not in there. Because without those three words, nothing else happens. None of it happens because the reason he was able to conquer over the Moabites was because of his left-handedness, okay? Because he's able to smuggle in a dagger and able to stab him with it, okay? Because guards of that time would assume you're right-handed, because why would you be carrying a blade or any type of weapon if you're left-handed? You wouldn't be doing anything. Because you're disgraced, you're weak. You would never hold a weapon because you can't use it with your left hand. Because that's not normal. So they would have checked. Guards, you know how the security checks you at an airport? They would check you for stuff. So they would check his left side for weapons. Because that would be normal for a right-handed person. You draw it from this side, right? I mean, you don't draw it from this side and go all like, look at me. You draw it from your opposite leg. That would be what was normal. So he draws it from his left leg. So he straps it to his right leg. And they don't check him at all. So he's able to smuggle in a gun onto the airport and the airplane and that kind of stuff. You know, that's basically what happens. And they don't even know about it. So that's why that's the most important thing, because without it, he would never be able to conquer that, and then they would still be under oppression for years and years and years. Okay? So he had a weakness. He was left-handed. And there's other people in the Bible who had weaknesses similar to this. You know, Moses, he had a stutter. That's why Aaron had to talk for him, you know? Or Abraham, he was super old, but he still had a child after that, and he was able to lead everybody. Or Timothy, he's too young. You know, Timothy was the guy who was under Paul, his disciple, and he was too young. Paul talks about don't let people look down on you because you're young. So he was a young guy. Gideon was a scaredy cat. Joseph was abused by his brothers. Rahab, she was a prostitute. That's a disadvantage. Why would you want that? David and the Goliath, he was too small. He was short. He was thin. He was a small guy. It talks about how Saul put the armor on him, and it didn't fit right because he's a small dude. He's not you know, tall in stature and strong and mighty like normal people of that day. He was a small guy. Okay? And also for David, he was an adulterer and a murderer. And Paul, you may not know this, but Paul was ugly. Paul was not a pretty guy. And that's important for today because being not pretty is considered a weakness in today's society because everything's about, oh, you got to look right, you got to be the part, you got to put on all the right clothes, you know, wear makeup if you're not pretty enough because you need to be pretty, you know. It's important to note because he was ugly and people would have been like, oh, but God used him. You know, he was one of the main guys who was torturing and killing Christians, and then God turned him around and used him to be the greatest missionary of all time, probably. And he had a huge weakness. Okay? The next thing I want to note for you is that Ehud used his weakness, disadvantage, imperfection, whatever you want to call it, to his advantage and ultimately to God's advantage. God's advantage, okay? And he used it to save a nation. He had one problem wrong with him, and he used it to save the entire nation of Israel. Three letters. Left-handed man. He used those three letters. That one thing about him, that he was left-handed, he used it. The world told him of that day that he wasn't good enough. You're not good enough. You're weak. You can't do anything with that left hand. You might as well cut it off. Learn how to use your right hand. But he didn't listen to any of that crap. He used it, and he saved the nation, okay? And it even talks about how he must have been smart, you know? He wasn't some kind of idiot, because he devises this whole plan. This is all his plan. He devises that I'm going to go there, give the tribute, then leave, and then come back and be like, hey, I got a secret message for you, but then I'm going to secretly have a dagger here, and I'm going to kill him, and then I'm going to run back, tell the people, hey, he's busy. I locked the doors, and we're going to go back, and we're going to take it over, just like that. So he's a smart guy. Ehud's a smart guy, okay? And he used all of that to save the nation. The whole nation. One man. It was literally one man. And then the Israelites were there to help, you know, actually conquer Moab. But without his one action, without his one weakness, Israel would not have prevailed. Okay? And the next thing to note is that God raised up Ehud. In verse 15, it says, when the people cried out, okay, so it says, for the Lord raised up a rescuer to save them. It does not say, oh, God just found someone. No, it says he raised him up. So what that tells me is that God put him there. God made him that way. God made him with a weakness in that time. God gave it to him. I think that's important to note because a lot of people think, oh, God couldn't give me something that's considered a weakness. God couldn't give me something that makes me disadvantaged or make me imperfect. Why would he do that? But he did it on purpose. God purposely planned for it. And then, just like I was explaining, without it, nothing would have happened. Nothing would have happened. God saved the entire nation through the man that he put there. He planted him there. I think when it says he raised him up, I think he's like 3 years old or something like that, and he trained him and made him into the man he wanted to be. That's what God did. It was not an accident. 1 Corinthians 1:27 says, God purposely chose what the world considers weak in order to shame the powerful. God chooses us and puts in us and allows us to go through hardship and weakness and puts in us things that we consider are not good enough. The world tells us are not good enough. He puts those things in us on purpose. And I'm sure a lot of us hate it. You know, we're like, why, God? Why would you put this in me? Why would you do this to me? Why would you let that person die? Why is there cancer in the world? You know, we say that a lot. Or I've heard people say that a lot, at least. You know, why does God let bad things happen? And the truth of the matter is, he does it on purpose. It's not like he's being mean. Actually, he's being so generous and graceful and merciful that he's going to make you do so much better than whatever the calamity, whatever the bad thing that is in you, whatever weakness you have in you is going to be given back to you. You know, If you give to God, he's going to give back to you tenfold, or whatever time number you want to give, he's going to give it back to you. That's the reason why there is pain in the world. Along with, you know, we sinned, so it's our fault. But God allows it to be there. So my question for you today, got two questions, is what is your disadvantage? What's your weakness? What have you gone through? What is your imperfection that God has allowed you to go through? What God has allowed you to be? And of course, I can't answer that for you. I mean, what has he placed in your life? What has God raised up in your life? Just like Ehud was raised up, what has he developed in you? And maybe develops not the right word, but allowed to be caused to you. What has happened in your life? Where have you been? What have you gone through? What have you deemed unusable? That's an important question. What do you think God can't use? You know, what is it? What is the world deemed unusable? Maybe that's the better question. What has the world told you you can't do? You can't do that. You're not pretty enough. You know, you don't got those abs. You're not strong enough. You're not smart enough. You're too old. You're too young. You are injured. You are weak. What has the world told you? You're not perfect. You're messed up. How could you be used? Because you're messed up. I mean, what is your weakness? I'm not asking you to just start shouting things out, but that's for you to think about. What is it? Because we all have something. I guarantee it, because we are weak. We are weak people. If we were strong, we could save ourselves. We wouldn't need Jesus. We wouldn't need to be here at all. We could be out doing whatever we wanted because we'd be strong, but we're not. We are weak. We are the dust of the earth. And the Lord has mercy on us and loves us so much that he's going to save us and use us for greater things than we could ever imagine. So some of you may think that it's weird that I'm telling you, but you're weak. You are a weak person. There's probably nothing in you that's actually strong because the Lord is strong in you. Philippians 4:13, for I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength. We don't give Christ strength. He gives us strength. We are weak. He is strong. We are not the Lord. So we have a weakness. And once you identify that weakness, which I'm sure there are several, I mean, I can just sit here and think of so many things in my life where I have a weakness and something bad that's happened to me, some sort of event that has caused me to be sad, to be depressed, something that has brought me down, whatever it is. You know, there's any type of disability or anything. I mean, it doesn't matter. You can go on and on and on. So once you discover that, you need to let God use it. Because Ehud did. Ehud let him use it and saved the whole nation. Okay? So what can you use to save a nation? I mean, especially our nation. We're really not. You know, it used to be called that we're the greatest nation in the whole world. And we're not. There's actually a video you can look up online where a guy talks about how we are so far behind the rest of the world. We have corrupted our nation. Our nation was founded on great principles, and now we are, you know, really low on the list. We're not the greatest anymore. There's plenty of other nations that have triumphed over us and are actually doing well, and we're not. So what can you use to save a nation? And maybe you're thinking, well, I can't save the whole nation. And that's okay. Nation is just a obligatory term just for what is your nation? Is it just your family? Is it just your city? A friend? You know, all of us have friends. So what can you use to save a nation? What is it? I mean, God can even use your sins. There's nothing too far gone for the Lord to use in you. And I'm sure you all are aware of your sins. We always look at those and we always cry out to God, oh, help me, Lord. I'm a sinner. We all have sins. But just because we have sinned, we have fallen, doesn't mean that we can't be used. Just because you're depressed or anything like that doesn't mean you can't get up here and lead worship and guide others to be faithful and worship the Lord who saved us because we are weak. Just because you're depressed doesn't mean that, or whatever else it is. I mean, just because you're an alcoholic doesn't mean you can't preach. Doesn't mean you can't lead others. Just because you're addicted to some sort of drug, you're addicted to pornography, does not mean you cannot care for someone. Just because you've had a weakness doesn't mean you can't save a nation. So I'm here to tell you that you can. Maybe better is God can, really. That's really what it is. God can. If you let him. So again, what is your weakness? Or whatever term, what is your disadvantage, imperfection, whatever word, what is your sin? What pain have you gone through? You just need to let God use that in you. Because he will. He's ready. He's sitting there saying, okay, I'm literally right here, you know, you just need to give me the ball, you know. I just need the ball, and then we can start playing. You know, give him the ball. Let go of the ball. If that's a good explanation of that. Let go of the ball. You know, I've heard a lot where when we are worshiping, we have our hands like this. Oh, God, give me more, but then a wise man was once telling me that we really should turn our hands over and because we're not holding anything in our hands anymore. We have let it go. Nothing. We can't hold anything in our hands this way because it's all out. It's all out, so we need to let go of what we've been holding on to, what we've been afraid to use because it hurts. You know, it hurts. I totally get that because it hurts. And pain is a strong thing. Pain will cause us to do a lot of things we don't want to do and hold us back from a lot of different things. But God is stronger than your pain. He's stronger than your pain. So I'm going to open up this altar for you to come and just to seek the Lord. Just to seek him and say, God, I have a weakness. Or maybe you just don't know. I mean, then cry to God and say, God, what have I been holding back? Really, that's what I want you to come up here and pray for. God, what have I been holding back? Let me let go. Help me let go. Help me to let go, Lord. So I'm going to open up this altar. So if you want to come and pray, I urge you and beg you to come up here. Pray. I mean, you can pray in your seats. You know how they come up here. It's not some sort of ridiculous thing to stay in your seat, but just be praying to the Lord. Because really, as Christians, if you're not praying, I'd be hard-pressed to say if you really are following after the Lord, because that's like our main communication with the one who helps us. So we should be praying to God. So you can start playing the music, and we're going to open up this altar. You can pray for each other. That's what we're going to do. We're going to pray and seek God's face.